Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Now, yesterday I spent a couple hours with a group of bhikkhunis that were visiting from Korea. So I'm sure you're all thinking, oh great, now Jody Powell's speaking and koans. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. So this is kind of a just a continuation of the morning reflection I gave yesterday. I was going to continue with that this morning, and then I kind of lost track of the day, and I realized, oh, wait, I have to give a Dhamma talk tonight. So my morning reflection is going to be stretched out. A couple mornings ago, I had been listening to a couple of talks of Ajahn Sona. I used the morning reflection of thinking about Ajahn Sona when he was 1 year as a monk in his first year or so, had met Bhante Dhammavaro, a really well-practiced, well-known monk, and had asked him I don't know if specific, if it was like asking him advice about the holy life or just practice in general, but his answer applies to everything. He answered Ajahn Sona just by saying, if you begin well, you will end well. That kind of brought up the reflection that, you know, like all of us came into Buddhism, came into meditation or are seeking in the holy life or as lay practitioners, you know, we're all seeking. You know, we wouldn't be here if we weren't trying to cultivate or to come to some understanding of peace, to have that as a reality for us. You know, continually, or not continually, but just bringing up in the mind, just remember back to what it was that inspired you to practice. You know, what was it that, maybe not necessarily the dukkha that we were experiencing, the suffering we had, but what was the ideal that we had? Oftentimes you think of ideals as being quite negative, but there was this image we had of Buddhism would bring us to a happiness, a peace, maybe bliss, and experiencing life on a purple cloud with rainbows. That may have been the image we had, and at some level there's that intuitive aspect of us that maybe knows that is a possibility, to be into rapture, to be into states of concentration, and maybe along the way we've kind of forgotten that, or the experiences once we do start meditating are often filled with physical pain, emotional pain. Especially the way we practice here, there's a lot, some physical work we have to do, and you might be tired, and the all-night sits, sometimes can really throw our kind of rhythms out, and just having to sometimes be in community life that can be difficult sometimes to get into states of concentration. And we can sometimes lose sight on that's what we were aiming for. And so when I was reflecting on this, I was thinking in particular, like in my own practice, there are times when, there is a struggle. There's a concentration isn't very strong, or there's a sort of sense of what I should be doing. What my mind should be doing, and it just, everything seems to be a struggle. And You know, if you just listen sometimes in the meditation hall, you know, don't meditate, but just listen to what's happening around you. You know, sometimes we can actually hear, you know, somebody that you can actually tell that they're struggling. At least from my own experience, I know what it's like when I'm pushing, you know, the tension in the breath, or you know, the restlessness in the body. You know, you can very well imagine that that someone who's, you know, kind of in that sort of state, that you know, they probably are doing the same thing. They're probably, you know, struggling and probably pushing. And you know, it's like, you know, whatever sort of like habitually we go to in our meditation, like if we're always pushing, we're always trying to, you know, have this view that we're trying to get somewhere. If I just put in, you know, a certain number of hours of meditation a day, then, you know, then I will get peaceful. And just, really, really pushing. And there are people that do that. They have, you know, like this little logbook that they can tell you exactly how many hours they've meditated. And there's that kind of saying, if you do something for 10,000 hours, then you'll develop a, you know, a completely new skill. But it's, you know, but you might be developing a skill of pushing and struggling. And, you know, thinking that, okay, if I push and struggle for 10,000 hours, then I will be peaceful. Well, no, if you push and struggle for 10,000 hours, you're going to be a skilled pusher and struggler. So it's to really pay attention. You know, this week I've been meeting with a lot of the guests in the evening, and you know, people have kind of asked me a little bit about, you know, Lumpur's teachings, and like the two pieces of advice that I hear the most from his teachings, what kind of resonates for me from Lumpur's teachings, are is that you know, pay attention to the results. You know, people will ask him a lot about, you know, should I try this or should I try that, or you know, what should I do? And his response usually is some level of, you know, just, you know, try something, you know, that's intuitive to you, but then pay attention to the results. And then the other sort of, you know, what are you paying attention to? What are the results that you should be paying attention to? And it's contentment, you know, always coming back to, you know, is it leading to more contentment or to dis-ease? And so it's really, you know, if that is our kind of, you know, mental attitude while we're meditating, is, you know, trying to accomplish something, trying to get something. It's like that opening line, there is no way to peace. So like if we're meditating, thinking that, okay, if we keep doing this, we keep pushing, we keep struggling, we're going to get peace. There is no way that you're going to get peaceful that way. And so, you know, second line is, peace is the way. And so it's, you know, just coming back to that, remembering that. And one of the reflections that Ajahn Sona had mentioned with that is that, you know, as we are struggling, because we do. If we weren't struggling, if we didn't have dukkha, we probably wouldn't be here either. So it's like when we are in any aspect of our life, meditation or anything we're doing, it's like when we notice that there's that struggle. Ajahn Sona mentioned that Ajahn Buddhadasa, a very famous or well-respected Thai monk, that he would, the way he talked about sort of, you know, the process of meditation or process of, you know, becoming an arahant would be that just, you know, starts off with just moments of enlightenment, you know, just having, you know, being struggling and then just stopping and remembering, you know, coming back to peace, you know, having a few moments, you know, maybe just even two or three breaths or even half a breath of being concentrated, you know, being quiet and being peaceful. And then of course we'll forget, we'll get swept back up into whatever we were struggling with before. But then remembering it again and coming back to it again is part of mindfulness, part of sati, is remembering and coming back to whatever it is the meditation object or the goal that we had set up. And then, you know, Buddhadasa just encourages people to just keep, you know, just keep stringing together more and more and more moments of peace together. And then, you know, that will be replacing, you know, an old habit with a more, you know, more peaceful one. And this week I also heard I listened to a science program called Radio Lab every once in a while. I hadn't listened to it for quite a long time, but sometimes they do these programs that are kind of more like on neuroscience, science of the brain, and they often tackle the question of self and, you know, what we perceive of as who and what we are and sort of moral ramifications of that and scientific sort of ramifications of those sorts of questions. And they were interviewing this scientist from University of California in San Diego. I think his name was Dr. V.S. Ramachandran. And he was describing this case of a patient that he had. And this patient had had some nerve damage into one of his arms. And it was creating just extreme pain for him. And he lost the use of all the muscle control in the arm, and so he'd have this extreme pain and contractions, and oftentimes his he'd have these contractions, and his fingers would sort of just get into a tight ball and would start, you know, kind of pressing into his skin and just being, you know, like almost cutting the skin and being very painful, and he couldn't control it, and so he spent a couple of years to sort of really pushing his mind, trying to, you know, tell his hand to relax, tell his arm to relax. And there was this, the muscular structure would not respond, or there was even, at least the way the story was told, it was like there was this, even like a negative response from the brain, like, you know, like he'd say relax, and there'd be this no, come back. And eventually the pain was so great that they had to amputate the arm. And it's not uncommon. I guess it's like maybe it's like 90% of the time, 95% of the time, when a limb is amputated, there'll be a phantom, you know, phantom pain or phantom sensations from an amputated limb. And so he's even though he didn't have his arm anymore, the pain was still there. It was exactly like it was before. And so when this doctor started explaining, you know, the patient was explaining to the doctor what was happening, he didn't know the whole history of you know, why the pain was there, how long it had been happening. So he kind of heard the whole history, and then, you know, he kind of got the intuition. I don't know if it's a phrase that he coined or not, but he called it phantom paralysis, or learned paralysis. And so for those 3 years that he had the arm, he had been struggling against the pain, you know, trying to tell his arm to relax, even though like he literally had no control of it. But for 3 years he tried. He sort of conditioned his mind to struggle against the pain and to try to tell the pain what he wanted it to do. And it wouldn't do that. So then when the arm was amputated, you know, of course the physical cramping, the physical aspect of that wasn't there, but he had conditioned the mind to react that way. So when the arm was gone, that physical pain was all created in his head. And he sort of points out that it wasn't delusion. It wasn't like he didn't think that he had an arm. It was, you know, so it wasn't delusion. It was, you know, it was actually really, really there and really, really happening. But then his doctor had a quite ingenious idea. What he did is he set up a mirror, or sets of mirrors, to put in front of the patient, and then and he held out the opposite arm, and then he set the mirrors up in a particular way that when he was looking forward, like let's say the was the right arm that was amputated, so he'd lift the left arm up, and then whenever in his phantom arm, whenever position he would sense that it was in, he'd have him put the his left arm in that same position, and then he would focus on in the mirror, like looking out, like he was looking at his right arm, and then he would very consciously tell him, okay, now go through the whole process in your head of telling yourself to relax the right arm, and then when he did that, of course, the left arm would respond, but he would see it as the right arm. And the very first time he did that, he said, and the very first time he did it, he was like, he regained all of the mental, like for the first time in his life, he could mentally have the hand respond in the way he wanted it to respond. And so it was like, then when the paralysis would start to happen or the contraction, he would... when he's looking in the mirror, he could relax that. So he gained control immediately. But as soon as he took the mirror away, the pain would be there, and he couldn't control it. It was only when he looked in the mirror. So obviously that didn't solve the problem completely. But then he decided he just gave the patient the mirrors and just told him to go home and practice. It was actually the words he used, just to practice and. Just to keep doing that, and about 2 weeks later, the patient called up and said, it's gone. And at first, he thought he meant the mirror. He thought maybe he'd lost the mirrors. And he said, no. He said the entire arm has disappeared. Like the sensation of the phantom arm completely disappeared. And so, but I really love that the image of the that phrase, the learned paralysis. And so I've been, kind of contemplating that. It's like this is, a physical structure, physical, the arm that he was, creating and struggling against. And, it's like I don't see why we couldn't be, learned paralysis in our own, what we consider to be dukkha, if it's a, some aspect of our life that we... some aspect of our personality we don't like that we're pushing up against, or while we're meditating, if there's a habitual physical pain that we have in the body, or Ajahn Amaro used to always say in terms of like community life that he used to always use the phrase stop creating each other. It's like you have views and opinions about each other. Which we can back up with by, I see him doing this, or I see her doing, or I hear her saying that, But, in reality, we really don't know why that person's doing something or saying something. And so we're like, we're creating that paralysis, the learned, we're learning that dukkha. We're conditioning ourselves to think in that way, to be in that way. And one thing with, Ajahn Amaro was always talking about, stop creating each other, is that, if we actually really strongly have a view, like, okay, this, this person is a good person. If I really think this person's a good person, we will actually start doing, actually Ajahn Suchito was talking about this, but he said, we will actually, if we really strongly believe it, either way, positive or negative or neutral, like if we really believe that someone's a good person, we will actually start doing things to make that person do things that are good. Or if we really believe the person's bad or evil, our actions, our attitudes towards them, things, the way we respond to them or talk to them, it'll be in a subtle way that will actually kind of influence the person to fulfill the behaviors the way we see them. And again, that's, I think it's just another way of sort of learned paralysis, or we are conditioning the world to be the way that we view it and the way we hold it. And so, this week in particular, when I was in the morning and evening sits, or sits in the afternoon, I've been really kind of really looking at that, like, so where does my mind habitually go, or where does it habitually struggle, and just trying to the particular types of meditation I've just been doing lately has just been more kind of calming, just trying to be peaceful. And of course, one of the biggest distractions that most people have is thinking. Just thoughts coming in and wanting to tell stories or plan things or. And not everybody, that's not everybody's, tendencies. But the mind is like one of the, they say it's just so fast, just extremely fast. And I was talking to some people after the meal today, and they were asking questions like, how can you get the mind to stop thinking? And I remembered Ajahn Amaro, he used to always answer that question with, there's nothing wrong with thinking. And people kind of, okay, that's true, but I want it to stop. How do I get it to stop? There's nothing wrong with thinking. But I'm supposed to be focusing on my breath. And then Ajahn Amaro would sort of, the way he said it that I finally kind of really got it for the first time was, he says, the mind the thinking is just, part of that, the mind. So if you have a brain, you're going to be thinking because that's one of the aspects of what a brain does. But like we have eyesight, we have eyes, and we can meditate with our eyes open, but we don't say, why do I have vision? I'm meditating. I shouldn't have vision. Stop seeing. Or we have, you can close your eyes and you don't have visions, but maybe you do. Maybe you have. Maybe you're a visual person. You can, even with your eyes closed, you can still see visions. But if you're not visual, then you can meditate. But we still have ears. We still hear things. I shouldn't be hearing things. Well, if you have ears that are functional, you're going to be hearing things, or your physical body having sensations. We don't think I shouldn't be having these physical sensations. And it's the same with the mind. I think one of the dangers, though, is the mind is that it's so fast. It's just faster than like lightning, and so we can be directing the mind in a positive, wholesome way, but it just like lightning can go in a completely different direction, and maybe even create a lot of harm. So it is, we need to be very careful with the mind. But so I've been kind of contemplating this lately, and. Just looking at how to what would be some skillful ways to, when the mind isn't settling down or it just starts to get into stories and a couple of maybe about 6 months ago I was giving a talk on the five different means for removing distractive thoughts I discovered a sixth one while giving the Dhamma talk of actually just removing thoughts, and that's trying to give a Dhamma talk on a list. My mind went completely blank. It went completely blank on all thoughts. So if you ever want your mind really to go quiet, just try to give a Dhamma talk, and then it'll completely blank out on you. And it was funny, at the time I actually was quite peaceful with it. I was like, yeah, this is nice. But the one that I forgot that I couldn't bring up to my consciousness was the looking the other way. It was the phrase of it. It was just when a distractive thought is coming just kind of look away is the phrase. And so I was I think part of the reason that image came to me when this week was yesterday. After the meal is over, there's a really wonderful training video we have in the office on trail maintenance, how to build trails and how to take care of how to use the tools and what the tools are and some of the techniques for making sure the walking paths in the forest are in good shape. And so we have a young man living here right now who wants to. Probably is going to take on that duty this winter of looking after the trails. So we, several of us, were watching this video, and then after watching that, there were it was two DVDs, but there were like maybe eight different sort of segments to this of different people presenting things. This is from the National Park Service and different rangers giving presentations on various aspects. And one of them had the title, something like, "I've Got an Axe to Grind." And I couldn't internally stop laughing when I was watching this video, because it was this ranger absolutely loved axes. And he loved axes to such a degree that he knew if you were watching his video, you loved axes too. And he was like practicing, you know, pure mudita, just, you know, joy, your good fortune of watching him tell you stories about axes. And so the whole time I was watching this, I was just like, it was so contagious, his sort of joy of axes. And he just giving you all every sentence, he was sort of using some sort of jargon of, you know, the language about axes and definitions. You know, if you were an expert in axes. And I had the insight listening to him, I was like, wow, that must be what we sound like when we give Dhamma talks, you know, using polyphrases. And it was kind of funny. But the one image one technique he showed was when you're splitting firewood. He just showed this really technique of, you know, at the very last second when you're swinging the axe, to just as the axe is hitting the firewood, you just take your wrist and just very slightly twist the handle, just as it hits, and that'll kind of, the momentum and then will kick the firewood off to the side. So it's like, usually if you just go straight down, sometimes it'll split and half the wood will stay up, or both of it'll stay up on your stand that you're chopping the wood on. And oftentimes if you do that, if you don't use like a tremendous amount of force, then the splitting maul or your axe will get stuck in the wood, or you'll have to spend a little time getting it out. But if you just, you know, do this, you don't even have to use as much effort to try to pound the axe all the way through, but you just hit it, and then just at the last second, just this little twick, and it'll you know, cause the wood to fly away. And so that night after watching that, that image just sort of came into my mind, and I was trying to be peaceful, and the story came in, and I just remember that sort of just twick, and, you know, flip the wood away to the side. And just the question came in, you know, it's like, like every moment there's peace. You know, it's like if you're telling yourself a story, or you're complaining about something, or being joyful about something, you know, there's all this activity in the mind. But it's just as easy for there to be nothing in the mind. If you just, you know, like any second, like, just like that, there's peace. Just quiet. So I can choose to talk. I can choose to talk for as long as I want to, or there can be silence. I can create that. And so to me, it's like that's what part of what contemplation is, or even sati, just to remember that there always is that moment of peace. And that's, again, I think what Ajahn Buddhadasa was pointing out, just creating more and more of those opportunities for peace. And so as my mind would start to tell these stories, I would just get this image of just that little, you know, pushing off to the side with the axe, that little twick, and just sort of, so I'd be sitting there telling the story, I would just say to myself, you know, is there peace? And it would just stop the mind, it would just jar the mind. And it didn't have to be, it wasn't painful, it wasn't like this sort of, you know, slamming on the brake and causing a 20 car pile up on the freeway or anything, but it was just this, oh yeah, go back to the silence. And so it was this really, you know, very gentle, but it was also very profound, because it was like, you know, there was a story going on, there was a dialogue, and then it just went into silence. And those, that list of removing of distractive thoughts, the fourth one in that list is very related to this as well, which was to just consciously, just like, I think of it as like slowing down. So there's a The analogy in the suttas is from the Majjhima Nikaya, is that it's like someone who's running, just can think to themselves, this is kind of tiring. Why don't I walk? And they do, and then they think, well, why don't I just stand? And then they think, well, why don't I sit down? And so the same kind of approach, that sort of just sort of bringing in, asking, is there peace here, is the same thing. It's just sort of that running of the mind. Just if I just let that happen and not make any efforts to slow it down or anything, it might wear itself out, but it might also do just the opposite. It might get agitated and lead to more difficult mind states, and or just even wholesome mind states, but just running. There's no peace there, and so that's the just bringing that up into the mind. I can just slow this down, or actually not just in meditation, but in all aspects. Especially during like the work scene, while we have work to do. And that doesn't mean that we have to work in slow motion and work really slow. Like today, we had a really beautiful work period this morning. We were all working up at the sauna area. Must have been about 12 or so of us up there, kind of doing all sorts of various tasks. And at a certain point, some of us got in a line of, like, say, 5 or 6 people to sort of passing firewood to each other in this, I forget what you call it, but just in a line, we're all just sort of passing the wood to each other, and just makes it really efficient get a lot of work done. And actually in any aspect of that, you can still work just as fast if you're quieting the mind and being really peaceful, or if your mind is racing and telling yourself all sorts of stories, it's more likely you're going to, miss a piece of firewood, or you're not quite as attentive. So being that, quieting the mind and slowing it down, in many ways gives you much more effort or potential to see, like, hazards, or to see where, you can be more efficient in how you're working, or more safe in how you're working, because your attention is focused more on really what's important, instead of just running random. So I really like that image of slowing the mind down, but it actually increases your awareness. And I was thinking the only other thing I was kind of contemplating talking about, kind of related to that, is that one of the reasons the mind might wander, or start getting into negative mind states, is a lot of times it's the, for me anyway, it's the physical discomfort. And it's this sort of, the mind sort of, telling stories is kind of a way of, not wanting to look at that, not, wanting to get away from that. I wouldn't say the best way, but another way to actually sort of deal with any of these sort of negative mind states or physical minds or physical states is actually taking interest in them. And when we take interest in it and start investigating or looking at it, or any sort of meditation object, like the more we get interested in things, the mind gets absorbed into it. And when that absorption happens, when there's interest, then there's energy. And again, I was talking about the 7 factors of enlightenment. So there's say mindfulness of your meditation object, and then when you keep bringing that up to mind. So it's like, I was talking about at the beginning was peace, having interest in a peaceful or quiet mind. So you're bringing your mindfulness to that. Okay, mind, peace is not present now, but it could be, and then it was there. So you're bringing mindfulness to it, and that natural will bring up energy. you'll have the energy will arise from that. And then when mindfulness and energy are there, if the conditions are right and you've applied the investigation is the next one. And you have that investigation, you're paying attention, there's the mindfulness, then that's when that's when energy arises. So with the three qualities of there, those together, then rapture. And it can be very subtle. It doesn't have to be a really pervading sensation, but it can be very, very pleasant. And the body starts relaxing, and there's often this sort of like tingling running through the body when there's energy and investigation going on, and of course the mindfulness is strong. And then when the body starts to feel relaxed and comfortable, with that's just subtle. Sometimes it's profound, but just a very gentle, sensation of rapture in the body, then tranquility. The mind can really settle down when the body is comfortable and relaxed, and the mind will become tranquil. And then when the mind is tranquil, concentration is a natural kind of process for that. And then when the very end, when all those factors are together, then equanimity. So they all kind of build on each other. You can develop each one individually, but looking at it in that sense, every time you meditate, just bringing mindfulness. Okay, what was that goal that I had when I first discovered Buddhism? What was my thought about Buddhism when I first, or meditation when I first got there? I really think that there is that potential for bliss, for happiness, for peace. And so you just bring that back to your mind, your mindfulness, and then investigating your own body. Is it there? Is it not there? When it is there, what did I do to make it there? Or a question I like to ask about kind of things like that, or loving kindness practices, what would it feel like to have peace? What would it feel like right now in my body to be quiet or to be peaceful? Just asking that question, sometimes we'll actually start to bring just a hint maybe of that quality. And then that's part of that investigation, just sort of looking, questioning. And then when the mind gets interested in it, then that will lead to energy, to rapture, to tranquility, to concentration, equanimity. I'll leave that for our reflection this evening. Sadhu.